in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Orpheum Children's Science Museum, a hands-on children's science center located at 346 North Neal Street in downtown Champaign, where science meets center stage, on the web at orpheum.science.museum.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here on the program Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. He is generally here. We try to have him on every season, at least, so several times throughout the year, to answer questions about cars and car care. And we're starting to get some people already ready to go here. The idea is that if you're having a problem, you can call in and tell us the make and the model and give the best description that you can. And then based on the symptoms, Rick will see if he can make some suggestions about what to do about it. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Just before we get to calls here, something that I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit right at the beginning was about mileage. Based on gasoline prices now, I think what people are going to want is they're going to want to try to get the best mileage that their car is capable of getting. So I guess my question is, are there some simple, straightforward things that people can do? And some of this might just go to the recommended maintenance that they're supposed to be doing anyway. But are there some particular things you think that people could do to try to make sure that they're going to get the best mileage that their car can get?
Well, as you mentioned, maintenance is probably number one. Tire pressures, make sure all the tune-up components, meaning spark plugs, using injector cleaner, which I mentioned typically four times a year. Obviously, one of the biggest influences on fuel mileage is your right foot and driving characteristics. If you have cruise control, obviously on the highway, the more you can use it, the better. Speeding, obviously the faster you go, the more fuel you're going to consume. You're displacing more air, the frontal resistance of the vehicle. And I would think that between maintenance and driving habits, that's pretty much all one can do.
Mm-hmm. What about filters? Like, particularly I'm thinking of fuel filter, oil filter. Do those things matter?
Well, fuel filter is generally a maintenance item. Some cars have a fuel filter, but it's inside the gas tank. It's considered a non-replaceable or serviceable item. The external fuel filters, I usually feel every 15,000 miles they should be replaced.
Okay. So basically those things, those maintenance items should be spelled out in the owner's guide, and it should tell you what to do and when, and the best thing that you can do is just go by what the owner's manual said.
A lot of the owner's manuals, I feel that they allow the fuel filters to stay on the car too long.
Oh, okay.
And some of them you'll see they'll tell you to replace it at 60,000 or 90,000 or maybe even longer, and I think that's too long. Obviously, any restriction in the fuel delivery is going to require you to step on the accelerator more. So you want to make sure there isn't any restrictions on the supply side.
There are some cars, and I know because unfortunately I have one of them, where the manufacturer recommends that you use premium gasoline, the one with the highest octane, which is, of course, the most expensive. How much difference does it make which grade of fuel you use? And if the manufacturer says, we really recommend that you use the top grade, what happens, you know, what do you lose if you say, okay, well, I'm just going to use the mid-grade or the least expensive kind?
Well, a lot of people kind of experiment with that. And they'll try there's basically the 91, which is what you're referring to, and then there's 89 and 87 octanes, so that's the middle grade. If you try the middle grade, the only thing that you may notice would be maybe a starting issue. Mm-hmm. They may not start the same or idle the same. If there's any spark knock, which is basically detonation that occurs upon acceleration, like when you're going up a hill, and it sounds like somebody's put marbles in a coffee can and they're shaking them, is what the audible sound is, then you have to go back to the premium fuel. I've heard people, they've asked me that question, and I said, well, just try it and see what happens. And some of them actually get better fuel mileage with the step-down gasoline than they did with the premium. So the answer to your question is try it.
Try it and see what happens. Okay. Well, we've got several callers now. The lines are full. So we'll start with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us a brief tutorial? I have a 99 Ford Taurus, and I would like to know what parameters you use to measure how well the air conditioning is working. Looking for a certain temperature drop from ambient or a certain discharge at the outlets and so on and so forth. So if you could give me a rundown on what that is, please, I'd be very thankful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Basically, what I do is close the windows, put it in the recirculation mode, maximum cooling if there's a selection for that, put a thermometer in the center vent, and let the car idle. And typically, after 3 or 4 minutes of idling, if it's ambient temperature obviously affects how well it cools because of heat transfer. Generally, you should see at least 50 degrees or less at idle. And the other indication of a vehicle that's low on Freon is, A, it won't cool very well, and B, if you listen carefully under the hood, you'll hear the air conditioning compressor click in and click out. So you'll, in some cars, when they get really low on Freon, it's a series of constant clicks where the compressor kicks in, kicks out. And what happens is the compressor kicks in, the pressures go down on the low side or the suction side, and there's a switch on the low side in the system. And the switch is in series to the clutch so that if the low pressure side gets too low, it opens the circuit to the clutch coil so that the clutch can't engage, so therefore you can't burn up the compressor or damage the compressor, because this recirculation of the Freon, there's also oil in the system, and that helps lubricate the compressor.
Okay. So how long would you expect the car to have to run before you're starting to get it cooled
down? It only takes
maybe
3 or 4 minutes.
Pretty quick.
It's fairly quick, yes.
Okay.
And then if you know much about cars and air conditioning systems on the compressor, there's two lines coming off the air conditioning compressor. One of the lines is larger than the other. The larger line is the low side. And that you can actually, if you touch that with your hand, it will be extremely cold. Sometimes they even frost a little bit and get moisture that occurs. But the best check is just simple thermometer, all the windows up, recirculation. I don't always put it on high. They don't cool as well on high because the air is going through the evaporator so fast that it doesn't get the heat transfer or the heat loss. So just on medium speed, about 50 degrees.
So then if you're in the car, it's really hot, you're trying to get it cooled down, then you would say it's actually better to set your fan speed on the medium setting, or are you talking about the setting where you set the temperature on the
medium? Well, initially, if you want to put it on high, it's obviously going to move more air and cool things down quickly. The other thing to do, depending upon the interior of the car, sometimes it's best turn the air conditioning on and get going down the road and put the windows down a little bit and get some of that right, because it takes a long time, particularly a black car, black interior. It takes a long time. And, you know, for 10 minutes, you're thinking, this air conditioner is really not working.
Yeah. So, and that's because it's so hot in the car anyway. And if you keep all the hot air bottled up in there.
Right. It takes a while for it to get the moisture out and cool that air down. So just let some of it out, and sometimes that helps.
Yeah.
But recirculation mode is where it keeps all the air inside the passenger compartment, and that's going to be the maximum cooling that you'll get.
All right. Let's go to Savoy. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
All right. This car has two problems. Now, this is a Fiat Spider 75. Now, the car sits all winter and all the bad months, so it'll sit 4 or 5 months without even being started. Now, sometimes... And this seems to be getting worse the last couple of years. All of a sudden, the garage will be filled with gas fumes. The car hadn't been driven for weeks. Occasionally, this even will start, this will happen in the summer. Sometimes I can detect a drip, which seems to be coming from the left front engine compartment area, somewhere between the back of the tire and the front of the door. Now, the other problem, I'm assuming these may be related, the other problem relates to how the car drives. So it drives rather well when it's freshly started. And in terms of starting, it starts always as it used to start. And in the nicer weather when I'm using it, if the car's been driven and it sits for an hour and I go out and start it, it ignites instantly. You couldn't ask for it to start any better or any differently. But what I notice is it doesn't accelerate very well anymore, and it doesn't generally perform. It acts like it's either getting too much or too little gas. Occasionally now it'll even stall, particularly if you're trying to push it to go in second or third gear, which, you know, the car always used to handle that very well. Now, when it stalls, and there seems to be no way to coax it into function at that time, so when it stops, then I crank it, and it'll usually start almost as well as usual. And it drives very well in first gear. These are the best things I can tell you about the car.
Now, this one is still carbureted?
I think so.
Right. Because kind of the area you were talking about between the left front tire and the driver's door, that's the proximate area of the carburetor. So what I would suggest after it sits for a period of time is that you open the hood and remove the air cleaner and just kind of make a visual observation of the base of the carburetor. You'll see evidence of gasoline. Even if the gasoline is not there, it will leave a stain. As gasoline dries, if you were to pour it on concrete, it'll still leave a ring. So there'll still be evidence of the leak. But it sounds like it's carburetor-related. Maybe the gaskets have dried out, and maybe the carburetor needs to be overhauled and rebuilt, all new gaskets and seals. And at the bottom of the carburetor, when it sits over time, if you're not putting any kind of stabilizer in there, or Stabil is one of the brands, moisture can accumulate in there and obviously some debris, and that can be affecting the way it runs as well. So if you notice anything externally leaking from the carburetor, which would be associated with the fumes you're referring to, then I was just rebuilding the carburetor.
And this would cover all these different
things? That'd be the first thing I would look at, yes.
Well, what could be the next one if that's not the problem?
Well, it's a fuel issue. I mean, the other thing I would expect is that when the car sits for a long period of time, you have to crank it for a lot longer than normal to finally get it started, because if the gasoline that was in the carburetor has escaped, you have to refill that before the engine will even begin to start. And then it typically will start and run rough and finally get better and better and better. Is that a scenario?
Actually, the long time sitting and starting, it's the same as it always was. It always needed to be pumped and,
right,
and cranked several times.
Mm-hmm.
If it sat for even 4 or 5 days.
Well, it shouldn't have to.
Certainly
be.
If it sits for weeks, true. Of course, the longer it sits, the longer you have to do this pumping and cranking. And I've even learned that sometimes you just pump it and crank it for a few times and then go away and come back 3, 4, or 5 minutes later, and then it cranks less and starts faster.
Right. Well, that's kind of going back to visually looking at the carburetor, and if the gas is leaking out of the carburetor, and that's why it takes longer the longer it sits, is to refill the carburetor before it will even begin to start. So the air cleaners aren't that difficult to remove on those.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Right.
Our guest this morning, this part of Focus 580, is Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign, and he is here every couple of months to talk about cars and car care. If you have a problem, call in and tell us about it, and he will suggest a solution. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Coincidentally, my daughter called about 5 minutes before you came on the air. She has a 94 Super Beetle, and this is what she says after repeated questioning, that after 5 minutes of driving the car or far from home, and if you slow down or come to a stop. As the slowing down occurs, the car wants to die on you. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And then you have to restart it. And this will continue on as long as you get up to speed and slow down or whatever it is, whether in the city or out in the rural area. And I thought I'd just throw it out. I know how to do simple things with VWs, but this certainly sounds, you know, to me like a vacuum problem or something like that, but I don't know the slightest idea, and I thought maybe you could, you know, talk about it somewhat. Thanks.
It's a 94?
Oh, I'm sorry, the caller hung up. Well,
maybe he'll call back because I'm not sure about the year.
Okay. If the caller's listening, you better call back, because I think Rick maybe wants to ask you a couple of follow-up questions just to make sure that he knows what year you're talking about. Otherwise, I'll tell you what, let's go on to another caller. We'll see if we can come back. Well, now the lines are ringing, and I'll bet it's the same guy. We'll just sit here, and we'll wait a little bit to see if we can get the guy. Yes, in fact, it is. Back with us here on Line 4. Hi.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm used to the usual, you know, get your question and get off.
Oh, so. No, no, no.
Well, I think in this case, sometimes it happens that you, you know, Rick might want to.
So I'm afraid that my ignorance is going to show here fast, because I ask her a lot of, you know, mechanical-type questions, and I just sort of got, well, all I can tell you
right.
is
That's
that
fine.
When you slow down, it wants to die.
Right. Okay, so it's a 94.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
No check engine light?
Didn't say a thing about it. I asked her about it, and she says, I don't remember, so.
Okay, well, that's important.
Yeah.
Because then it would be associated with one of the sensors that the computer is.
Yeah, that's where I was leaning, but I haven't said anything. So I'll get back after you talk here. I'll get back to her.
So, yeah, I would try to find that out and then find somebody that can hook up to the computer and monitor exactly what's going on.
Okay.
Some of those have problems with. Now, there's kind of a host of different things, and the check engine light obviously is probably the number one question.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Okay, and if it does come on, you know, just find somebody with the computer to set things
up.
Yeah,
then it'll be very easy.
Okay, now if this happens and the engine light does not come on...
Then it could be associated with the idle speed motor.
Mm-hmm.
It may be sticking.
Yeah. Okay.
And sometimes the computer won't catch that.
So I know the next question she's going to ask me, well... Is the sensor, when it goes up bad at first, does the engine light come on? Okay, does that what happens then? I mean, it's immediate.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably what she will ask me when I ask her. But thanks a lot. That
You're helps welcome.
Quite a bit.
All right, very good. We go to Monticello, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Hi.
A couple of years ago, I bought a 1983 633 CSI, a BMW, and at the time the odometer said about 170,000 miles on it, but the speedometer and odometer don't work. I've noticed that having driven it for a couple of years now, the service lights also have never come on, which I think is probably not right. I replaced the magnetic sensor in the rear end for the electronic speedometer, and that didn't have any effect. And I'm wondering, it appears as though the instrument cluster has been removed at some point, and I haven't pulled the dash apart yet, but I was wondering if perhaps the reason the speedometer doesn't work is because someone's disabled the service lights. Is that possible?
No. Those old cars, the service lights, there was a series, they looked like AA batteries, and it's been a while, I have to think. We used to take those out, yes, I have disabled them before, but disabling them does not disconnect the speedometer odometer. So what you need to do is pull the cluster out and check the single wire coming up to the instrument cluster, which is from that Hall sensor or the AC generator on the rear end, and it will generate an AC signal. And you can check that with your volt ohmmeter. And that's how I check it. And if you've got the signal and you've got the ground, then the speedometer needs to be rebuilt. And
I see.
You send it away and they can rebuild it.
Is that a pretty common problem with the older BMWs?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And the service lights may be just simply associated with the fact that there's no battery life left in the dash. And they're, like I said, they look like AA batteries.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And we'll continue. Next is Rantoul. That's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. This may be a very simple question, I hope. And I have to admit that I'm in my 80s and I know very little about cars. So I have an older Buick. I think it's 86 or 87. I took it to one of those fast food places and had the oil changed. They told me at that time that I needed the transmission fluid also changed. Well, I didn't have time, so I didn't do it, which probably turned out to be a good thing. So at any rate, last week I took it in, and as it turns out, it's a rear-wheel drive, which I didn't know, and they did not have the correct filter and couldn't get it. So I took it to some. I took it to a person to a garage that my husband normally took it to have it fixed, and because there was a problem with the windshield wiper, and they fixed that, and they so I told them about what I'd been told about the transmission fluid. And they said, oh, no, you don't want to change your transmission fluid. If you do, you will ruin, you could, not you all will, but you could ruin your transmission. What you need is power steering fluid. So I really want to know if that is correct.
How many miles are on the car?
Oh, not even 100,000.
Has the transmission ever been serviced?
Not that I know of.
Then, in this particular case, when you open the do you understand what it means to service a transmission?
I have no idea.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Okay, basically what they're talking about is removing the pan, which is at the bottom of the transmission. There's a filter inside there.
Okay.
And you're going to replace the filter, the gasket between the pan and the transmission, and then all new fluid. That's the service that they're referring to.
Mm-hmm. So how can it ruin the transmission itself then?
Sometimes if a transmission has never been serviced, my approach on that is that I explain to the customer that if we service your transmission, it's a kind of a 50-50 chance. When you take that pan off, clean the material out, take the filter off, sometimes you knock some little pieces loose just in the process.
Oh.
And those little pieces, the transmission is a very precise component, meaning that small pieces of debris, if they get stuck in the valves or valve body and anywhere, it can affect the way the transmission shifts or affect its longevity. So if you have that mileage and it's never been done,
I don't think it has.
Okay, then
leave it alone.
Like I said, yeah, either leave it alone or do it, but you have to understand going into it,
mm-hmm,
that there's a possibility, okay, that there may be further problems.
Okay. Well, the thing is that when it's well, sometimes even when it isn't cold, when I first start the car and turn, it's very difficult to turn. So I assumed that that was the problem. But if I have the power steering fluid replaced, you think that might help?
Okay, now the steering effort being high in the morning doesn't have anything to do with the transmission.
Okay.
Okay. Typically, on the older Buicks, General Motors products, when it was very difficult to turn the steering wheel either to the right or to the left,
mm-hmm,
and you had to wait for a little while, and then all of a sudden, if you like kept your hand on the steering wheel and just kept slight tension on it, it'd feel like it just kind of break loose almost. It would all of a sudden
get... No, it isn't like that.
When does it eventually get normal?
Oh, after I drive for a while, it seems to be warmed up.
Right. So what I'm saying is if you were just to start the car and leave it in park,
mm-hmm,
and turn the steering wheel slightly, just keep pressure on it, after maybe... I don't know, it might take upwards of 5 minutes, but eventually all of a sudden the steering wheel will become easier to turn.
Okay.
And if it does that, the problem is in the rack and pinion, the steering gearbox. They used two dissimilar metals in what they call a spool valve, and it would actually bind or drag. And the only solution, provided that the fluid level was fine, which if the fluid level was low, you'd hear a real loud whining noise or buzzing noise.
Okay.
So then that means the rack and pinion needs to be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
Now you should know that this is not a safety issue.
Okay. That's good to know.
It's an annoyance.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. Well, the lines are open. If you have a question for Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service, you can give us a call. He's here with us several times throughout the year to talk about cars, and if you have a problem, give us a call and tell us what it is, and he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things I want to ask you about a little bit was ethanol in gasoline. Now, I think almost all of the gasoline that we get now has 10% ethanol.
I believe that's correct.
Pretty much.
There was a time where it had a say it on the pump if it contained it, but I believe you are correct.
And I think that it's also correct that any car should be able to run on that blend as long as it's no more than 10%
correct
ethanol. So here's the issue. I'm thinking now maybe people are hearing more and more about this blend that's called E85, which is 85% ethanol and the rest is gasoline. And there are some cars that specifically are designed so they can run either way. They can run on that and they can run on the other blend that's a more common blend. So it's sort of, you know, whatever you want to put in your car, whatever's least expensive, that's okay. As long as you know that it's okay to put that in your car. What happens if you have a car that it's not designed to run on that heavy ethanol blend? I mean, what would happen if you put E85 in a conventional engine? Would that be a problem?
I would sure think so in terms of drivability and the way it idled in particular. It's going to have to do with the internal engine design of the combustion chamber and how the fuel is delivered and how it's burned and the flame front. I mean, there's a lot of technical things associated with your question. But if it's not designed for it, I would not put it in.
Okay. Well, I guess that's just what I'm thinking about. I just want to make sure that people understand that unless they know that specifically that their car can take that E85, don't put it in there.
Right.
And in fact, I think probably in most cases you should, you know, one of the things that would say in the manual is this is what we recommend and that it's okay if it's got some ethanol in it, but no more than that.
Right.
10%. Okay. Okay. Let's go to Champaign here for another car. Line one. Hello.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I have an older car I'm wondering if there's any way to check the starter on it. The starter turns the engine over very slowly, and it, like I say, it's an old car. It's a 1960 Alfa Romeo, and I'm wondering if there's any way to test that starter.
The best way to test it is to remove it from the car.
Right.
Because it's not that difficult on that one.
Yeah, we've got it out.
Okay, and then just take it to an electric rebuilding shop, and they can do what's referred to as a load test current draw test on the starter, and they can answer your question very, very quickly. And if the starter tests okay, then you need to look at cleaning all your cable connections, ground, positive, and battery age.
Okay, I've done that. I've taken it to one place in town, and they didn't say anything about a load test.
That's really not the right word. It's current that we're monitoring here. We're checking how much current it draws while cranking.
Okay.
And you typically, on the car, it's usually around, on a warm day, it should be maybe between 250 to 300 amps, I would think, somewhere in that range. Ideally, down around 225. But that you can test on a car with like an inductive amp meter. So I would call them and ask them about the current required to turn the motor.
Okay. I'll try to do that again. I thought we could do that. I did take it, like I say, to one place in town, and
they said it was okay?
No, they weren't willing to look at it. They said they'd have to take it apart to look at it, and if there's something wrong with it or if they found something amiss after taking it apart, they would fix it, rewind it, or do whatever was necessary. But did not offer to load, like you say, load test it.
Current
test it.
Right. Well, maybe you should just put it back on the car and get an inductive amp meter and see what kind of current draw there is, and then at the same time monitor the battery voltage.
Yeah,
and see what it.
We've done that. We monitored the battery voltage. That we can do while cranking it.
What does it drop to?
It does not drop very much. I mean, down to 11.5 or something.
And it still spins slow?
Still spins slow, correct.
And the starter, the engine itself, if you crank the engine by hand, it's not like it's hard to turn or anything, is it?
No, we're able to do it by hand, but I'm not sure how easily it is. I mean, it's difficult to do by hand, but can be done.
Okay. Well, from what you've told me, then it does sound like a starter problem.
Okay. Okay. Appreciate the help.
All right, sure. Thank you. Let's go to Rockford, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I've got a 2001 VW Passat with a 1.8 turbo engine in it, and the temperature gauge will all of a sudden peg out to the right, and the stop engine light comes on. And if we turn the heater on, we can get the temperature to drop back down, and then things are back to normal. I've replaced the thermostat twice. I've put in a new water pump. I replaced the VW temperature sensor, and it still does it. The overheating indication.
Does this, you say while driving you turn the heater on. If you were to, like, sit at a stoplight for 10 minutes, what would happen?
It's nothing. It seems like, you know, if you can drive high temperature and then slow down for city driving, and then all of a sudden the temperature gauge will come up.
Okay, so I'm sorry. If you drove from here to, let's say you went out on the highway and you drove 20 miles, would it overheat on the highway?
Not necessarily. No. It's usually at a slower speed.
Okay. And
the electric fan works, and there's two fans on the radiator. The electric fan works, and the one that's belt-driven both work.
Got a lot of miles on it?
About 130.
Well, you may have a problem with the radiator. The other thing to do is to make sure that when the cooling fans come on, I mean, this may sound stupid, but I've seen this quite often. When the cooling fans come on, you want to make sure that if you put a piece of paper in front of the grill, that it draws the piece of paper toward the radiator and doesn't blow it away. I have seen fans wired backwards. So when you're going down the road and the fan comes on, you've got air going one direction and the air, as you're traveling, is trying to go the other direction. So obviously no air goes through the radiator. But
okay.
You may have a radiator issue. If you feel the upper hose and the lower hose, you should feel a slight temperature difference between the two.
The top one will get nice and hot, and the bottom one will be cooler.
Mm-hmm. And you definitely got all the air out of the system.
It's got the coolant overflow, and that's the highest point on the system.
Right. Yeah, it pretty much will bleed itself. So when it's at idle, does the heat work well?
Yeah, most of the time the heat gauge sits right at 190, which is, it's just, every now and then I'll do this. You know, you can drive for 2 days, nothing happens, and then all of a sudden it happens. And then just this, the putting on the heater fan on high, you know, will drop draw the temperature down, and then it goes back to 190, and it'll stay there.
Mm-hmm. I would suspect the radiator. You can take it to a radiator shop, and they can check it with, like, an infrared temperature gauge. And see what it's doing. Because if the fans are working, it's a factory thermostat you put in there?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And then you've also replaced the sensor, which you're referring to one for the gauge.
Right.
Okay. Well, it's the only thing left.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
So now I'm curious about these radiator fans being wired backwards. Was that something that happened at the factory?
No. This is, in the course of its life, something's happened.
Oh, something happens that it gets disconnected, and then you put it back, and then put it back the wrong way.
Yeah, okay. It'll run you for a loop for a little while, something like that.
But, well, you probably wouldn't really think of it right offhand that somehow the fan was blowing the wrong way.
But the key to his problem was his answer to the question, if you drive it for 20 miles on the highway, does it overheat? And the answer was no.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's a lot of air going through the radiator on the highway as opposed to in town.
Yeah.
So it tells me that it's a radiator issue.
Okay. Well, we keep going. Got some other callers here. We have moving into about our last 15 minutes or so. Rick Karch is here from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. If you have car questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
About a year ago, I have a 2001 Toyota Camry, and about a year ago, the check engine light went on, and I took it in, and they said it was the EGR valve, and I think they replaced the EGR valve, but then not long after, the check engine light came on again, and I took it back, and the code was for the EGR valve again, and it sort of, every time they reset the light, it comes on again and shows the same code for the same problem. And I was wondering, is it just a problem with the check engine light or, what could it be?
This is the four-cylinder?
Yeah.
Yeah. I should say probably 80% of the time on EGR problems with the Camry four-cylinder, it's the little solenoid, the electrical valve down under the intake manifold that's bad. The only other component in there, there's like an amplifier, but I haven't seen those go bad very often. So I would suggest the solenoid.
The what?
The EGR solenoid. That valve.
Okay, it's hard to, maybe I'm on a cell phone, but could you repeat?
The solenoid valve for the EGR valve, yes.
Solenoid valve.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they replace the EGR valve, this could still be a problem?
I've seen that more than anything else on that circuit.
Okay. So take it back and tell them to check the solenoid valve?
Yes.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks.
Let's go to Savoy. Another caller here. Line number one. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I've got a 2000 Ford Taurus with that regular six in it. And, we started, it's got about 93,000 on it, and some of the oxygen sensors went bad on it, and we replaced it. Then it started flashing the code that the camshaft position sensor was bad, so we replaced that sensor, and it still kept flashing that code. So we replaced the synchronizer underneath it that's connected to that camshaft.
The ring?
Yeah. There's a sensor. It's like a distributor.
Right.
So we replaced that assembly. So basically what we've done is we've replaced all the oxygen sensors, and we've replaced that switch and the synchronizer, and now it's flashing. It's called code P1309, and it says that the misfire detection system is disabled. What do you think could be going on here?
The code specifically says it's disabled?
It says that the misfire detection system is disabled.
What else does it say? There's got to be more.
No, that's it. It shows no faults, but it says that it's been disabled. And whenever I got a better explanation of the code from the dealer, they said, well, it could be the camshaft position sensor, which we've replaced, or it could be the engine coolant temperature, which is working, or it could be the airflow sensor.
Mass airflow?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen those go bad? And
the mass airflow?
Yeah, and still have the engine, you know.
Yes.
Okay.
I would go, but let me back up a minute. Are you still getting the crankshaft position sensor code?
No. What it shows is, it shows that no faults, it shows, whenever it's been diagnosed by computer, it says, no faults detected. But it flashes that code 1309, and it says for some reason or another that the misfire detection system has been disabled.
I just have to read. There's associated with that code, there'll be a what's called a flow chart.
Yeah.
And you just kind of go through it.
Yeah, the flow chart said check the camshaft position sensor.
Mass airflow.
Yeah, mass airflow and engine coolant and the crank position indicator. And basically, you know, we've replaced everything but the mass airflow and the crank.
Okay. These are problems that, this is one of the problems with these new cars.
Oh, yeah, they're not perfected by any means.
No. Yes. The codes are, you know, and then people wonder why it takes an hour and a half to diagnose this stuff. The only way I do these anymore is I have a lab scope, and I monitor things. And a crankshaft position sensor, camshaft position sensors, you can monitor them both at the same time, and you can see what's going on. If there's something, you tap on it, wiggle the wires, but that's the only way I know how to diagnose something like this. Same thing with the mass airflow sensor. Some of the Ford mass airflow sensors, they've got the tamper-proof screws on there.
Oh, yeah.
And if you take that sensor out and look at it with a magnifying glass,
yeah.
Sometimes you'll see some of these air filters, the fibers come off them. It looks like there's hair on there.
So it could be dirty.
Exactly.
I see. Yeah.
And then they make special spray chemical. You don't want to use carb cleaner. You want to buy a mass airflow sensor safe. Cleaner. So if you see that hair on there, that will definitely affect that voltage value.
Okay.
But if you monitor it, you would see it immediately.
Okay. Well, here's what it was doing beforehand. It was stalling, and it was misfiring under load, and it kept flashing that CMP code, that camshaft
mm-hmm.
code. And I came to the conclusion, well, yeah, hey, yeah, that probably is part of the problem. And then I think a mass airflow, whenever it starts to go bad or it's irregular, it can create trouble, like you say. The only other thing it said was possibly the main computer.
Well, it'll always say that. Every code.
Oh, okay.
That's right. Part of every code.
All right, I want you to guess. Is it the mass airflow sensor?
Well, I wouldn't guess. I would monitor them.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, I mean, it's cheaper for me to. Yeah, that's an easy thing to change.
Well,
you know, just go ahead and change it.
Well, that's why it gets expensive to fix cars, because you know, if you just start throwing parts at things.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, eventually you'll fix it, but plus all the time and frustration associated with it, where you can find somebody that's got a lab scope, or even a scanner that has a lab scope function.
Yeah.
And you can monitor those sensors and see them while you're driving. And most of the scanners allow you to record things, too. So you can put it on record.
Oh, okay.
And then when it triggers the code, it'll immediately start recording. And then when you pull over to the side of the road, and you can scroll back and you can see what transpired.
Okay. All right. I got you. All right. Hey, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. We have time for about 5 minutes left. Time for a couple of more callers here. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. So now that there are all these sensors on the car and that you can plug them into a computer and have the computer tell you something about what's going wrong with the car. Now, does that actually make it easier?
Yes.
To fix it? It really does.
Oh, yes.
To do the diagnosis, figure out what's going on. It does.
Yeah, years and years ago when I started working, I don't know, it's probably been back in the late 60s, those cars, they had a check engine light, and the light would come on, and then you'd have to ground some wire, jump or two wires, and the light would flash, and it was very, very archaic compared to today. You know, there might have only been four codes, you know, in some of these cars. There's just so many different codes. And obviously the newer the car is, the easier it is, because the codes have become more precise, as opposed to years ago we'd get a code of running too lean, meaning not getting enough fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the list would be, you know, injectors, ignition, compression, fuel filter, oxygen sensor, mass airflow sensor, airflow meter. And you had to go through every one of those components and test them. And hopefully, in the process, you could duplicate the one that was at fault. Now, it's very explicit. I mean, it'll have a code, kind of like the previous caller. It specifically said crankshaft position sensor, and you go right to it. So, yes, it's easier, if things do get easier.
Okay. Let's take some of the calls. In fact, now we got a whole bunch. We'll start out with somebody on a cell phone in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a Toyota Camry. It's a 96 four-cylinder. I have 471,000 miles on it, and it's doing fine, but for one thing. I have a check engine light that came on some years ago, and when I had the man look at it, he said it was the emissions control valve, some sort of thing that would cost a fortune to replace, so I didn't replace it, and he turned my light off with his computer. And then a couple of months ago, the light came on again. So I thought, well, this must be something new. So I took it to the dealer, and he said it was the exact same thing. And I said, well, I haven't replaced it in 7 years. Why would I do it now? Please turn the light off. Now my light's back on again.
Well, the only way you're going to get the light off is to replace that component then.
Okay.
The problem...
Pardon me?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It doesn't affect the way the car drives, so I'm not going to worry about it.
I think what you're referring to is it associated with the gas tank and the pressures maintained in the gas tank? Is that kind of ringing?
I think it has to do with whatever they explained to me that it had to do with emissions control, whatever the required gadget is that they put on cars.
Well, I'm not sure. That's kind of a broad... broad word. I mean, emissions could be what comes out the tailpipe. It could be the fumes that are stored in the gas tank and how the fumes are purged from the gas tank.
Okay.
Generally, if it's associated with that, then you are correct. You will not notice any difference in the way it runs other than the light being on.
Okay.
So maybe get a little more information from them.
Well, you know, they give you their little computer and they say, oh, no, that's exactly what it is, but they don't give you more information. So,
well, I'm sure they'll help you if you ask them. Say, please explain this to me.
Okay.
I'm sure they will.
Okay. I figure with 471,000 miles, I'm doing all right.
Oh, yes, you are.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go.
Bye.
Champagne.
Bye.
Line 1. Hello.
Hi, we have a 93 Camry with about 128,000 miles on it, and the transmission's been a little bit questionable for a while, and, you know, we just try to drive it carefully, and we don't take it on long trips, and, you know, we're just planning to drive it until the transmission dies and then make the decision at that point as to, you know, whether we should replace it. But lately we've been getting at idle, at stops, a lot of vibration, and it doesn't happen all the time. It doesn't seem to matter whether it's cold or hot or whatever, and we've done all the obvious kinds of things, you know, like tune-ups and all that. Could this be transmission-related, or do you have any guesses?
Yeah, more than likely not.
Okay.
The next time you drive the car, it doesn't matter if the air conditioning's on or the air conditioning.
Yeah, it's been doing it for 6 months probably all season.
Okay. The next time you drive the car, when you have it in drive, see how it feels, then put it in reverse and see if it changes.
Okay.
If it changes and it's smoother in reverse, it needs engine mounts.
We've done that.
Okay. And these were factory mounts?
I believe so.
Is it idle too low, maybe?
We've tried adjusting the idle, and it doesn't seem to help at all. I mean, if anything, it made it worse, probably.
So then the engine must be running rough.
The engine was running fine, normally. And then you adjust the idle, and it made very little difference. Maybe made it a little bit worse. I know that if you're sitting at the light and it's really vibrating like crazy, I think if you shift into neutral, it does help it.
But it still feel it.
Yeah.
Well, then it doesn't sound to me like it's running on four cylinders.
Compression testing comes out okay.
I understand, but we've got injectors, ignition. I guess the first thing to do is verify that it is, in fact, idling on four cylinders.
Okay.
And they can test that for you.
Okay.
But if you've put mounts in it, and then it tells me that it must not be running on four cylinders.
Okay. And, well, how do they really check that?
Well, you can monitor it on an oscilloscope, and you can see each of the individual cylinders and how they're firing, meaning how the plugs are firing.
Okay.
And then you can go through and load balance. In other words, short out cylinder number one and see what RPM it drops. Do number two. In other words, as you drop each of the four cylinders, the RPM should come down the same amount.
Okay.
If you get to one cylinder and you disable it and the RPM only drops 25 RPM, then you know that's the cylinder that's not functioning 100%.
Okay. And is that fixable?
Depending on what the problem is, yes.
Okay. I mean, okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
All right. Thank you. We'll go real quick, try to get here. Line number two, cell phone. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Good morning. I just picked up, 20 minutes ago. I got back in the truck and heading down to Champaign. Appreciate your show.
Sure.
Question related to 1990. This is more of an economics question. 1990 Ford F-250 Plain Jane four-wheel drive on farm truck. We keep it titled, insured. This is a three-quarter ton, long bed, but it's got lockout hubs. And we run it very infrequently now. Years ago, we lost the catalytic on it due to a she plugged up. The pellets came loose. And we never did replace it. But we knew as a result of that the gas mileage was going to drop considerably. Of course, the gas mileage on that, loaded or unloaded,
doesn't
is
matter.
10 mile a gallon.
Yeah, right. We got to kind of be quick here. Question.
Is it really, now I'm down to about six or so. Is it really worth replacing that with an aftermarket catalytic?
It would be. Most of the aftermarket catalytic